Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. Thank you so much. Tonight, do you feel different, Mike, Emily, Audrey? Tonight, we have become a premium show. Yes, I forked up the money to be able to do the show, continue to do the show in prime time. Those are hours, according to Blog Talk Radio, between 7 p.m. and 11 p.m., so we decided to do that. We were thinking about a half-hour show at 11 o'clock, but, you know, what can you do in a half hour? So we're still going to be on 1 hour, and it will be on at the same time, 9 o'clock every Thursday evening. And our switchboard looks a little different, Audrey. Maybe you can help me with some of the things up there. I've got Skype to call out, and I've got, what is this other thing? It says I can move my host to the screen. I don't know if that moves my seat or what, whatever it does, but probably somewhere there's a manual to read so I could understand this. I'll have to find what it is. But ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network again and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. And although we're premium, whatever that means exactly, we'll continue to do our show as usual. I'm your host, Keith Haley. I want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that wonderful trip across the United States to 90 cities and states, excuse me. Emily and Mike, thank you for joining us tonight also. And our show is going to be the same as it always is. Our purpose is to discuss news, issues, events, and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And I should mention, by accident, I discovered I was looking for a clip that I was going to use of Dr. Charles Williams when he was on our show. And Dr. Charles Williams is a border security expert, and I was doing an out-of-town speaking engagement, and I wanted to play a clip. So I'm using the Google address bar. You know, you don't have a search bar anymore in Google unless you want to use it. And I was looking for Dr. Charles Williams, and boom, he comes up in podcastdirectory.com, and lo and behold, every show I've ever done in chronological order is listed on podcastdirectory.com. Just type in Jumbo Justice, or if you look for a particular show and you know who the guest was, you can do it on that show. But I was surprised to find that they're all there. You can get them off of Blog Talk Radio. They're a little harder to find. But podcastdirectory.com gives you a right to that stuff. Of course, there's a lot of other things on there that you're allowed to download and listen to. And I think there's some video downloads there, too. I'll have to browse around on that site a little bit more. But our show is dedicated to those energetic and tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. What we try to do is look inside the practice of criminal justice and take a close-up look at its professional. Tonight we're going to do that under the, I'm really interested in this show, and I actually am going to go read this book, and I'll talk more about it here a little bit later, but we're going to listen to James Bamford talk about a book he wrote called The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA, National Security Agency, from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America. But anyway, it's going to be very interesting. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio. Get your own show. If you don't have one now, it's absolutely free. You can get a half-hour show. I guess you can't be in prime time anymore, but you can be before 7, and you can be after 11 p.m. if you want to fork up just a little bit of money. You can become a premium show and broadcast in the hours that you like and as many times a week as you like, I believe. What is possible, any interest group, any person, any organization can have their own show, and they can broadcast live on Blog Talk Radio. Just think of it. 10 years ago, I always say that. 5 years ago, this is almost unbelievable, and you can do it absolutely free, as long as you're not a premium show like we are. It's not free, but, you know, it's not that expensive either. The shows are archived immediately for replay on MP3 in MP3 format for downloading. So get your own show. If you don't like this one, you can certainly do it. Tonight's show, I've already told you what it's going to be about, and I think you will indeed enjoy this. You can listen on your computer. I can actually call out now, since I'm a premium show, on Skype. Skype up there, I've got a button. I can call people on Skype. I can actually see things about people that call up. I'm not sure what I can see. But anyway, we'll try to figure that out later. If there is a manual, I'm sure there is. But anyway, you're listening on your phone. You can listen on Skype, as a matter of fact. And now we can actually hold as a premium show, I can't imagine why we'd want to do this, 50 callers. We don't usually don't have one, let alone 50. But, yeah, it said 50 callers as opposed to the 5 I used to say. So you could have a whole class show up or something like this. Well, Audrey's got a blonde joke tonight, and she promises me that this is going to be one of the shortest we've ever had. But I like it. It's a funny one. So, Audrey, why don't you go ahead with your blonde joke for tonight?
Professor Haley, our blonde joke for tonight is about as brief as they can get, but it is a funny one and I think our listeners will like it. Here it is. A blonde was playing Trivial Pursuit one night. It was her turn. She rolled the dice and she landed on science and nature. Her question was, if you are in a vacuum and someone calls your name, can you hear it? She thought for a time and then asked, is it on or off?
All right, is the vacuum cleaner on or off? I get it. All right. She is it. These blonde jokes are just outstanding. And Audrey is, by the way, a blonde and a collector of blonde jokes. She's done it since childhood. Born in London, England, she has one of the world's largest collection of blonde jokes in hard copy. So that's unusual in and of itself. Well, we're going to play the Ohio Gun Coalition's audio about the dangers of firearms. And this week, I caution people to think about these kinds of things. And we're certainly not making light of the tragedy in Tucson. And I think I'm probably going to make just a few comments about that. I've heard so much silliness related to that incident, this terrible incident where children and elderly and the congresswoman were shot. Thank heaven she is. She seems to be recovering. Everybody said that. But terrible thing. And this, I would just call him screwball guy that was doing this. You know, everybody's looking for a cause. I've heard everybody talk about this, but I've never heard a criminologist talk about it. And being a criminologist, I, you know, maybe later may do something about this in terms of a whole show or something. But I don't see any need to do that tonight. Well, Ohio Coalition, go ahead and give us your caution about violence.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and we will certainly pass that along to all the criminals that they should not carry They should not carry firearms. I'm sure that's who that message must be directed to. Well, we have a green tip for tonight, as usual, and we're going to take it, could you guess, from Esma Floyd's little book, which is little, called 1001, those are big numbers, they're hard to get right, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. We've already done tip number 273, and right below it is tip number 274, and 273 was to limit your toilet flushes, and 274 is an expansion on that idea, and it's entitled Don't Flush at Night. Why not make it a household rule to not flush the toilet at night? That way you'll save water and you won't make noise that might disturb the sleep of others in the house. Excuse me, there might be some other consequences of that, but remember that, don't flush at night, you'll be saving water. You know, talking to environmentalists about saving the planet and planet sustainability and all that is almost like, isn't it, Mike, like talking to an economist? I mean, you're not an economist. Well, this causes that, and that could cause this, and if it caused this, these other things could happen, but one of them could not happen, which might turn into that. And it's kind of the same way with trying to trace your toilet water, isn't it, or any other green tip. It gets very, very complicated. I think I need a manual, or I need it sketched out so I fully understand it. But anyway, that's a good tip. Remember that, no flush. No flushes at night. I wonder how many people will be following that one. Few, I would imagine. All right, let's take a look at the news tonight before we get to our feature guest. And there is some interesting news along the line. And I thought I might start out with this one. You know, nobody likes to pay taxes. And we've changed the tenure of the House of Representatives, or the makeup of the House of Representatives. Now the Republicans gained a big majority, and one of the things they're interested in doing is reducing taxes. And I don't think we talked about this last week. I should have written it down, but I don't think so. But this was in the newspaper, and it has to do with a protest that witches in Romania, a place I've been to about 20 times, 21 times, I think, in Chitila, Romania. Everyone curses the tax man, but Romanian witches are angry about having to pay up for the first time, and they hurled poisonous mandrake into the Danube River Thursday to cast spells on the president, Prince President Bucescu, and the government. Romania's newest taxpayers also include fortune tellers, but they probably should have seen it coming. Superstitions are no laughing matter in Romania, the land of the medieval ruler who inspired the democratic tale of the Dracula tale. And they've been part of its culture for centuries. In fact, President Traian Băsescu and his aides have been known to wear purple on certain days, supposedly to ward off evil. The witch at the Danube named Alicia called the new tax law foolish. What is there to tax when we hardly earn anything, she said, identifying herself with only one name. Yet on the Chitila River in southern Romania, other witches gathered around the fire Thursday and threw corn into an icy river to celebrate Epiphany. They praised the new government measure, saying it gives them official recognition. In other words, if you can tax a witch, then we think that you're real. Isn't that something? But a little bit of humor on the relative to tax laws. Let's look at this one. Illinois is finally, after years of struggling, and Governor Ryan's commission. Is Governor Ryan out of prison yet, Mike? You recall? I can't remember. Anyway, Governor Ryan, before he went to prison, they investigated him for 4 or 5 years. And then when they finally convicted him for corruption in office, over a period of 5 or 6 years, they finally sent him to an honor camp in southern Wisconsin. That sounds like a good place to send a crooked politician. But anyway, Illinois' House just voted last week to join 15 other states and who do not have the capital punishment or do not have death penalty. And they're not sure whether Governor Patrick Quinn, he's a Democrat, is going to sign that. But they would be joining 15 other states that do not have the death penalty. You know, some states, you can ask the question whether they have the death penalty in reality or not, because they're, California's got, what is it tonight, like 600 and
90 people almost on death row. In other words, they don't execute people very often. So, in essence, they don't have a death penalty. But I thought that was interesting that they finally have done it. And Governor Ryan's commission, which lasted, I think, a couple of years, came up with all kinds of recommendations. One of them was that the eyewitness testimony to a murder would not be good enough in court for somebody to give the death penalty. So if somebody broke into your house and shot a family member, you saw them do it, they wouldn't be able to get the death penalty because you were the only person that saw it happen. Isn't that incredible? Yeah, I think it is. How about this one? You know how our border security is so good? So let's see if I can find this story. But this one is almost off the page. Yes, a woman has an egg. Some people might know what this is. I don't know what it is. But there's a cross-border disagreement agreed over a popular chocolate treat. Nearly cost a Winnipeg, Canada woman a $300 fine, and it saddled her with a bureaucratic headache. Lynn Bird was recently stopped at the border and selected for random search of her vehicle. She was warned that she could have faced a fine after the customs official found and seized her $2 Kinder Surprise egg as illegal contraband. Bird learned that the United States authorities had banned the candy because they come with a plastic toy inside that could, if eaten, choke a small child. It's just a chocolate egg, Bird said. And they were making a big deal out of it. But if you're caught at this, you can get charged a $300 fine for having a chocolate egg called, what is it called again? Where did I just go? Anyway, don't buy this particular chocolate egg because it will get you in trouble. Oh, it's a Kinder Surprise, yeah. What else could a child put in their mouth that we could ban? Lots of things, right? I thought that was unusual. Well, aren't we looking for illegal immigrants and things like that? Maybe some bombs and big heroin caches and marijuana loads and things like that. But we're out there finding every little chocolate egg that we can find on the border. I find that amusing. You know, there are cases of justice every now and then. Florida was one of the first states here several years back to pass what they call the Stand Your Ground Law. And what that means is that when somebody breaks into your house or they attack you, you don't have to wait for them to almost kill you to protect yourself. So here's a guy that's out jogging. He was confronted by two youths while he's out on a late night run. He appeared to defend himself. He was punched in the face, and fearing his attacker was armed, he pulled out a handgun from his pocket and shot dead the teenager who had hit him. As this gun debate rages on here in America, in wake of the Tucson experience and all that, prosecutors reported that Rule Baker should not face charges, even though 18-year-old Carlos Musteller did not have a weapon. In other words, before this time, before Stand Your Ground Laws, you had to wait and figure out that they had a weapon. In other words, if somebody pulls out a gun and shoots you, you figure out, yeah, they had a weapon, but I can't respond because it's too late, I'm dead, right? Or somebody stabbed you or something like that. So now we have, I think, 20 or 21 states that actually have the Stand Your Ground Laws. And the same thing happened for your house. We talked about that before on the show. You don't have to wait for somebody to pull out a weapon when they break into your house. They are, in a sense, as people are fond of saying, paid for the minute they come in the door or the window or up through the cellar or however they get into your home. So I would call that justice. And some of you know I had a grade school acquaintance who way back who was beat to death on the street to Springfield in the same situation here. He was out jogging, something had done night after night for years. And I think it was four guys that jumped him and beat him to death. And he died the next day in the hospital. Now, had he had a firearm, probably all he would have had to do was pull that thing out, and they would have taken off. But he never got that chance. Would you believe that that Glock pistol that was used in the tragic shooting in Arizona, Tucson, the sales of that Glock are up like 60%? So they predicted that every time something happens like this, of course, gun dealers and manufacturers
think and citizens think, oh, you know, there's going to be another restriction. I won't be able to do this. But the Glock is a very popular popular weapon that comes in from Europe. And so now they've already introduced legislation in Congress to ban the 30-round magazine, which allowed him to get off so many rounds. That kind of makes sense, I would think. But banning the guns and all, there'll be all sorts of things going on all over the place. Anyway, the sales jump in this one particular store from went up 60% one day sale to 263 sales in one day because people are thinking this thing might have been banned. Sales rose 65% to 395 in Ohio, 16% to 672 in California, 38% to 348 in, what state was that? Illinois, oh my. You can still have guns in Illinois. But anyway, nationwide, they're thinking this went up about 5,000%, 5%, and made perhaps a sale of 7,906 firearms. So, you know, there are probably going to be legislation introduced all over the place. The congresswoman from Long Island, I think her husband was killed on a commuter train or something like that, and she's already introduced legislation either to ban the Glock or the multi-fire magazine. So we'll have to see how this turns out. I wonder if the sale of books about guns are up. I have one on Amazon.com. Yes. With Liberty and Guns for All, a primer on America's firearms debate. Okay, let's see what else we can do here in the news here. Thank you for paying your taxes. Speaking of taxes, I have a news story here that Saginaw, Michigan is now going to install, the City Council on Monday okayed a contract with the Midland-based SecurityCom Incorporation for a 40-camera surveillance system. It's only going to be used in one particular neighborhood. In September, workers helped install the first stage of RAPTOR, the Regional Analysis of Police Technology and Operations Reporting Initiative, that synchronizes 17 public surveillance cameras to monitor the new Anderson Celebration Park. So this is going to be it's going to cost $300,000, but Saginaw does not have to worry because the $300,000 comes from a federal grant. So thank you for paying your taxes in Saginaw. I'm sure we'll be safer. I guess you've probably heard some of the more recent stories that show that the same money spent on streetlights all over the city, streetlights reduce crime more than surveillance cameras do. So we'll have to see what happens in that regard up in Saginaw. I look for the crime rate. I think it's fairly high there. Don't quote me on that, but I believe it is. So we'll have to see what goes on. They also have the gun tracking sound system there called Shot Spotter. And when rounds go off, they can try to figure out exactly where that round went off. And then 25 minutes when the cops later or 20 minutes later when the cops get there, of course, the criminals are gone. But we tried that out in Dallas years ago and decided it wasn't worth it because there were too many gunshots to respond to. I can remember a friend of mine, I won't even say where he taught, but he said that, you know, you could hear gunfire almost every evening in some of those areas. So anyway, Kentucky Senate is going to do something interesting or has done something. They're trying to crack down on illegal immigration. Yes, it is possible that Senates do something like that. But on Friday, they voted to enlist law enforcement in a stepped-up fight against illegal immigration by passing a bill that would give police broad authority to check the immigration status of people they think. So this is a follow-up on Arizona's 1070 Senate bill, which, you know, is going through all kinds of court tests, and the federal government's giving them a bad time about that, too. But Kentucky does not want to be a sanctuary state. And the people in their Senate say we need to do something about this. So the bill now goes to the Democratic-led House, where its fate is uncertain. But anyway, it seems reasonable that, you know, if you stop somebody legally for something else like stopping,
What's the first thing you check? Your ID. Who are you? Where are you from? And then the first, like, reasonable suspicion that, you know, you're not from here and you don't have a driver's license or you have illegal credentials, false credentials, then maybe you should allow the police to investigate a little bit farther. But that's Senate Bill 6 in Kentucky. We'll have to see how that that one turns out. This one is interesting. Arizona's immigration law faces a new challenge. They're going at that one every way they can. That's that Senate Bill 1070. That's one that they all commented on, and I had mentioned that I at least 90% of the people that were talking about it hadn't read it. It was only like 17 pages. I read the whole thing. And they kept saying that the cops could stop you anytime they wanted and check your immigration status, which was patently false. They had to stop you for some type of legal violation. Then there had to be reasonable suspicion beyond that that you were not in the country legally before they could continue to investigate. So that wasn't true. But they're basing this contention here in Arizona for day labor on day laborers who stand around the parking lots you've seen if you've been in the Southwest somewhere or maybe up north too, where they come and stand around and then contractors come and pick them up and give them jobs and pay them, you know, either under the, well, they pay them under the table for sure. And they don't work with a legitimate employer. So now they're contesting the Arizona law by saying, ACLU is helping, of course, leading, and they're saying that this is a violation of their First Amendment rights, the illegals' First Amendment rights or their free speech rights. And in other words, it entitles them, this free speech rights entitle them to go out and solicit for a job. In a parking lot or wherever they do it. Wait a minute, they're not here legally. Well, that's right. Our Constitution doesn't apply. It does apply to people here in the United States and aren't citizens. But for illegals, this is really something. But we'll have to see what happens on that one. Okay, I think that's probably enough for what we want to do. Tonight relative to the news. There's some other things going on, but they're worth holding over. I'll hold them over to next week. We're going to shift now, and we're going to listen to James Bamford, who has written three books about the National Security Agency. And most people, I would say, clearly 80% don't know zip about it. And, you know, we had a show once, and we had Shane Harris talk about The Watchers, the book, fairly recent book he wrote. And he's been a specialist on that National Security. But the National Security Agency is the oldest of all the security agencies. And the title of Mr. Bamford's third book on the subject is called The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. And his other book was called The Puzzle Palace, 1982, and then A Book of Secrets. That was a book he wrote in 2001. You are going to shudder over some of the things that this National Security Agency has done over the years, including things like using a submarine to wiretap or to monitor conversations and the cable lines going across the oceans. It didn't work out very well. But I'm going to leave you to one surprise. I hope we get to it. I didn't take too much time. If they don't, if we don't, I'll mention it. Something that the NSA missed relative to 9/11. And I've already given too much away. But anyway, let's go ahead and listen to James Bamford talk about the Shadow Factory, or in other words, the National Security Agency, the most secret of all of them. Here we go. Give me a second to set it up.
Has written about the NSA in two previous books, The Puzzle Palace and Body of Secrets. He discusses his latest book with Jonathan Landay, National Security and Intelligence Correspondent for McClatchy. Mr. Landay previously worked for Knight Ridder and the Christian Science Monitor.
Welcome to Afterwards. My name is Jonathan Landay. I'm the Senior National Security Correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and I'm here today with James Bamford to talk about his new book, The Shadow Factory. It's a book about the National Security Agency, the largest and most secretive U.S. intelligence agency, It's the agency that goes out and monitors communications all over the world, digging for intelligence abuse to the United States government. He is the author of two previous books, groundbreaking books on the NASA Security Agency. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
On my way over here, I received a press release from the American Civil Liberties Union talking about how they have filed Freedom of Information Act requests with the Justice Department and the National Security Agency, seeking documents outlining their policies on how they protect the privacy of U.S. persons as they collect, private U.S. citizens, as they collect communications. And this was prompted, this request was prompted by revelations that were made by two of the individuals who are in your book. Can you talk about that?
Yes. The way the NSA intercepts communications, these talks on communications, is by having people that are largely in the military that sit at listening posts and have earphones on, and they listen to communications. And prior to 9/11, prior to the changes, the war on the eavesdropping changes, no Americans were supposed to be listened to. Any time an American came up in communications, they would be eliminated from being listened to. They would turn the scene off, stop recording, and so forth. And that's what one of the intercept operators I interviewed told me. And then what she said was after 9/11, after the changes, the Bush administration's war on the eavesdropping program, everything changed, and they began eavesdropping on American citizens, Americans talking to Americans, and recording, transcribing, and storing all that information, even though a lot of it was just personal talk about home finances or bedroom talk, whatever. And that was what made the people I spoke to very angry, because, first of all, they felt it was a violation of the law, and secondly, they felt they were wasting time by eavesdropping on U.S. citizens having personal conversations rather than trying to find terrorists, which is what they both went into the military for. And this ACLU lawsuit, or rather the ACLU press release, I think relates to that desire to get the actual documents. What is it that the NSA has that instructs these people what to do when they pick up an American communication?
Now, what we've heard since the revelations of the NSA eavesdropping on Americans without permission from the courts, and this was in 2004, we've heard countless assurances from both President Bush, from other senior people in the administration, both in the Justice Department, the former head of the NSA, General Hayden, who is now the director of the CIA, that American civil liberties, American privacy have been protected. This seems to indicate otherwise.
Well, it seems to indicate actually the opposite. They're not only not being protected, they're being exploited. One of the intercept operators I interviewed said that when they got in salacious or sexual conversations between husbands and wives, for example, or soldiers in the field and their girlfriends or whatever, girlfriends or boyfriends, that they would pass those conversations around in the listening post and say, hey, you got to listen to this one. And they're all listed on each other's computers. They look like iTunes. And so they would just say, click on number 37, and they all listen to it and giggle. And, you know, people over there are risking their lives and fighting, in a war. I don't think should be expected to have people back in the U.S. government here making humorous comments or making jokes out of their private lives.
One of the questions that all of this raises, at least in my mind, is how valuable has this program been since it was put into place after 9/11 and has been collecting who knows how much, not just conversations over the telephone, but emails and various other, the data, so-called data mining techniques where the government goes in and grabs people's personal files that are on massive computer databases, both within the government and private industry. How successful has it been, if at all, in actually ferreting out active terrorists and active terrorist plots?
Well, it hasn't been very successful. There was a recent report that just came out within a few weeks ago that I think it was from the Congressional Research Service that showed that the data mining that the government puts so much emphasis on with the CIA, Total Information Awareness awareness and lots of that shifted over to NSA and this whole idea of gathering everybody's receipts from every time you go through a toll booth, every time you stay in a hotel, every book you buy, all that, you put it all together and you find out who the terrorists are. What this report says is it's nonsense. It's sort of black magic. They make a lot out of it, but nothing comes from it. And it is sort of similar from talking to the intercept operators. One of the shocking things I felt found was that in talking to one of them, at the major listening post, again, the major listening post for the Middle East.
This is the one in Georgia.
It's in Georgia. It's not in the Middle East. It's not anywhere in the area. It's just below the South Carolina border near Augusta, Georgia. It's hidden windowless building wrapped around by barbed wire fences. And this is the largest listening post in the world right now as far as NSA eavesdropping goes. But what the intercept operators were saying was that the quality of the intercepts were extremely poor because the quality of the process in getting these intercepts was very poor because they didn't have the right people speaking the right languages. One of the people that was there until 2003 said that during that entire time they didn't have a single person that spoke Pashtun, which is the principal language in Afghanistan. And if you're going to go after the Taliban, which is the same time we went to war with Afghanistan, it would be nice if they had somebody that spoke the language. So what they ended up doing was they created a small little class there to teach them, but because Arabic and Pashtun were so different from each other, nobody ended up learning anything from the course. The other thing was that a lot of these people are taught the classical Arabic, the standard Arabic, and not the dialect. So when they're put in this position of eavesdropping, they're not really hearing the language the way they should be. They're hearing the language without the proper dialect. And one of the intercept operators said that was an extremely a difficult problem. And to give you an idea why this would be such a dangerous problem, not only here but over in Iraq, is that you get these people and they're picking up conversations, and it's Ali talking to his brother Muhammad, and the person's typing out this transcript, and he's saying, "I'll bring over the melons from the garden tomorrow." So then the person sitting there eavesdropping on this, he doesn't really understand the dialect because he's never been out of the country and he's not very familiar with the culture, has to say, "Is this really melons he's talking about, or are these IEDs?" And if he says IEDs, then, you know, there's a good chance that person's going to have a bomb dropped on his house and his family killed, or they're going to be house raided and the person put in Abu Ghraib or something. The person I talked to, the intercept operator, said that was would give them nightmare at night, thinking about all the innocent people they may have killed by putting a comment when they have no idea. They're half the world away, sitting listening to some conversation between people they've never heard of before, and they're making life and death decisions over whether the person's telling the truth or whether they aren't.
One of the scary things is questions that was raised in this chapter of the book that we're talking about, and this has to do with this system called the Highlander system, I think, is the idea that, as you said earlier, American journalists, American soldiers even, American aid workers were being targeted by this system, their conversations recorded. And there's a suggestion here that one place where these people were staying was a hotel that was subsequently hit by the American military. Is the allegation that perhaps this hotel was hit as a consequence of it being targeted by the NSA?
Well, that's it's an interesting question. I can't give a definitive answer to it, but what it implies is that you have intercept operators that were picking up indications that this hotel was going to be targeted, and the intercept operators were telling their fellow soldiers in the army that they, this is where all the journalists are staying, but it was hit anyway. And those are the dangers. You've got people listening to these conversations, and whether the proper actions are taken after they listen to it, you never know. And that was one of the things that was just really enlightening to me, was the amount of information they were bringing in, but the lack of real intelligence they were getting out of all this information. And so one of the both of the intercept operators were complaining most about. You know, it's very hard for having written 3 books now on NSA and having done this since 1982. It's very difficult to get somebody who worked at NSA to come forward, giving their name and speaking publicly, especially on television, saying what goes on because of all the pressure on them never to say anything. But here, these people came forward, even though there's not only no benefit, there's potentially a lot of deficit for them coming forward. But they felt very strongly that what they were doing was wrong, illegal, moral to some degree, and just a waste of time and money.
Now, you say in the book that this program was clearly illegal. Let's go back to the basics, really, about NSA, mm-hmm. what it was set up to do, and why the eavesdropping on American citizens without a court authorization is illegal.
Well, under the original Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was established in 1978 in order to prevent abuses like had taken place earlier. Part of that law said that if you want to eavesdrop on a U.S. person, you have to get a warrant from a secret court. The secret court is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. What it is the court acts as a buffer between NSA, which does the eavesdropping, and American citizens who were potentially subjected to this. So NSA wasn't allowed to eavesdrop on U.S. citizens unless they got the okay from a judge in the court. This is not a very difficult court to get a warrant from in 30 years. They've issued some 20,000 approvals, and they've only issued about 2 or 3 denials. So it's a court that is easy for NSA to get the warrants if they want to. So bypassing the court really made no sense to me.
And NSA was set up in the aftermath of World War II to eavesdrop specifically on potential foreign enemies of the United States. Is that correct?
Oh, sure. It was established following World War II to succeed the agencies in World War II that broke the Japanese Purple Code and the German Enigma Code. And they wanted to continue this through the Cold War, focusing on the Soviet Union. The NSA was formed in 1952. It became an agency so secret that even Congress wasn't told about it. Its very name was top secret, unlike the CIA, which was formed through Congress and the public law. So NSA was given the charge of basically listening to foreign communications and basically trying to find out when or if the Soviet Union is about to launch a nuclear attack. The whole job was to prevent another surprise attack like we had at Pearl Harbor.
The communications back then were very different from what they are today, the way that the data is carried around the world. And it kind of made NSA's job somewhat easier, didn't it, when back then a lot of most communications was by satellite.
That's right. Most throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, and throughout much of the 1990s, the main way that the United States received and sent international communications was by satellite. And that was very beneficial for NSA because if it wanted to eavesdrop on those communications, all it had to do, which it did do, was build these large satellite dishes. One was in Sugar Grove, West Virginia, another was in Yakima in the state of Washington. And they pull in all this communication from the satellites and then put it through computers and so forth. And there was no need to ever let the telecommunications companies know about it because they could do it with satellites hidden in the valleys that are unseen by or hidden basically from the public. That changed in the late 90s because telecommunications has changed. Instead of going by satellites, most communications now, international communications, started going by undersea cable. And that's because of the development of fiber optic communications. That's where the communications go through the cable in the form of a light beam, a photon, as opposed to an electron, as opposed to an electrical cable. You can put far more capacity in there, and it's far more reliable. So there was a tremendous building boom on putting these cables under the sea. And then communications companies using those. And that became a very big problem for NSA because it communication started drifting away from the satellites and onto the undersea cables. NSA had difficulty collecting that information. It left them with only two options. One, they could put a submarine down to tap the fiber optic cable. And according to people I've talked to, they've never had real success in doing that. And it'd be very difficult, time-consuming anyway, and we only have one submarine that can do that. So the other alternative was to make secret deals, secret agreements with the telecom companies. And this isn't anything really new. This is the third time that the U.S. government has gone to telecom companies and asked them to secretly turn over their communications. We did it in the 1920s. We did it from the mid-40s up until 1975 when it was discovered, Operation Shamrock and then shut down. So they did it again. The idea was to go to the telecom company and say that we need your help. We need to get into your private communication systems. And they agreed to it. What happened after that was the NSA started building these secret rooms inside the telecom switches. These are two buildings without windows in major cities like in San Francisco. Now, what's interesting about this, I just finishing up a documentary for NOVA that I was working on that airing in January, and we traced the path of all these communications around the world. And it's interesting because most of the telecommunications from Asia and the Pacific area all come into the U.S. On this one beach in California. And then they go up to this little building about 2 miles away. And from there, then they go to other large switches, AT&T switches. Now, if you were going to, if all you wanted was to eavesdrop on international communications, the communications in and out of the United States, that's where you would want to put your secret room because that's where it all comes in and where it all goes out. But what NSA did instead was they built it in this large switch in downtown San Francisco. And that's not only where a lot of the international communications comes in, it's where a lot of the domestic communications.
So they're seeing everything.
So when the cables all come into this one particular floor of the building, they're put through what's known as a splitter box, which is basically a prism that separates the photons and takes one photon and basically creates two of them.
It's a mirror image.
Mirror image of the cable. So one cable, the original cable, continues on to the proper communications networks in the U.S. and to the recipients. Then there's this new cable, clone cable, mirror image cable, that now goes to the next floor below and into the secret room that's controlled by NSA. This was revealed originally by Mark Klein, who was one of the supervisors and happened to see the room and got very angry that the U.S. government was tapping.
And there was a court suit, wasn't there, against the company that was doing it? He testified.
That's right, and the court suit is still in the final stages. The problem is it was by the Electronic Frontier Foundation against AT&T. And the suit, it was a very powerful suit. It had eyewitnesses and so forth. And I think it probably would have been successful. The problem is the Congress and their legislation last summer creating this new amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act made as one of those amendments immunity for the telecom companies. So I don't think it's been dismissed yet, but it probably will be dismissed soon. Although EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, decided to file another suit hoping to find the constitutionality of that immunity grant.
In the lead up to writing about all of this, you start before 9/11, and you take us through 9/11 and the NSA's involvement in history in that, and then you start talking about what it went and did, because it seems, at least from what I've read in the book and from what I've myself reported on, that people in the U.S. government went overboard in terms of their perception of the al-Qaeda threat, the terrorism against the United States. And the idea that the president in time of war has this overwhelming power basically to do what he wants. But talk about before the situation just before 9/11, where you have this situation where you have everything coming over fiber optic cable, and yet the NSA had managed to locate
this sort of communication center in Yemen that Osama bin Laden was using to coordinate his network outside of Afghanistan. They knew where this place was, and they actually had the names in their gigantic database of at least one or both of the men who were the sort of the main foot soldiers in recruiting people and carrying out the 9/11 attacks. Can you talk about that?
Sure. This is an area that was fascinating to me because the 9/11 Commission completely bypassed looking at NSA, which was extraordinary to me because a lot of intelligence agencies, but they wanted to focus primarily on the CIA. What I found was that prior to 9/11, the NSA had been eavesdropping on bin Laden's operations center, which was his house in Yemen. And for this NOVA documentary I'm doing, we actually went to Yemen and we found the house that NSA was eavesdropping on. NSA was eavesdropping on this house, bin Laden's operations center, for about 3 years. And in December of 1999, NSA picked up this message sending these two people, Khalid and Nawaf, to Kuala Lumpur for a very secret meeting. Apparently, it was going to be a terrorist summit meeting. And NSA passed that information on to the CIA and other agencies, and they began trying to find these people. The CIA had some surveillance on them, but they eventually lost them in when they flew from Kuala Lumpur to Bangkok. But these people ended up back in the United States. The two terrorists were in the United States as of January 2000. So the original two terrorists on the 9/11 plot first arrived in the United States in California in January 2000 and moved to San Diego. One of those was Fareed al-Midar, and he was married to a woman who was living in the house, the command center,
in Yemen.
So he was communicating back and forth. Also, she was pregnant, and he was wondering about the, when the baby's coming and so forth.
So he's on the phone.
He's calling back regularly. The NSA is intercepting a lot of these communications. They've got the time, the date, they're actually picking up these signals, listening to these conversations, which are happening very frequently. But they're not telling anybody that these people are in the United States. They're virtually not telling anybody anything. I interviewed the person who was head of the bin Laden unit at the CIA. I interviewed him for the documentary. And what he said was that they were trying to get this information from NSA. You know, what is it that these people at the house are saying? What is it that people at the Midar and so forth are saying? And all they would get would be small summaries once a week or something like that. And they're saying, we need the actual transcript.
But did they know that these guys were actually in San Diego?
No, they didn't. They never told them. They never gave them the transcript of the conversation. It got so bad that the head of the bin Laden unit at the CIA had the CIA actually develop their own intercept facility out in the Indian Ocean. I think it was on Madagascar. The secret intercept facility that intercepts the same communications from that house. The problem was they were only able to pick up one half of the conversation, probably the downlink. I think it was the downlink that they got. And so they went to NSA and they said, okay, we're now able to get half the conversations on our own, but can you give us the other half of the conversation? And NSA still refused. They met with the head of operations at NSA and they refused. It got so bad that the terrorists that were living in San Diego eventually moved across country a month before the actual attack and set up their final command center in the same town that NSA exists. Laurel, Maryland. They were literally just about 2 or 3 miles away on the other side of the highway.
I put that out of the book, which I found amazingly ironic.
And for a month, the terrorists and the eavesdroppers were living in the same town, shopping at the same Safeway. They were sending their messages at Pluto's. They were sending money back to the Middle East at Safeway at the same time that NSA employees were there working out with NSA employees at Joel's gym. And you could almost been up in the director's office at NSA a number of times. From his window, you could almost see where that motel was that they were staying at. So it's the ultimate irony in 9/11 that you have the terrorists living side by side with the eavesdroppers and the agents of the paying about $8 billion for, never told anybody where they were or never tried to even look for them.
What I also, and then correct me if I'm wrong, but you have the director then of the NSA, Michael Hayden, General Michael Hayden, a longtime veteran intelligence official. In the middle of all of this, when he's seeing that they are, in fact, picking up these conversations from inside the United States, says, we got to go dark. We cannot collect this intelligence anymore. I guess because he figured he had to obey what then was the FISA law. Is that correct?
But he was overcompensating for what the law was. I remember interviewing him in his office, I think right around the same time the terrorists were in San Diego, and he said at the time they were only eavesdropping on less than half a dozen people in the U.S., and I don't think they even wanted to do those. The problem was NSA didn't have any problem on there was no legal problem prohibiting them from eavesdropping on the 9/11 terrorists. First of all, they knew they were terrorists. They were being sent from Bin Laden's operations center. Their names had been in their computer for some time. And, the question is, what are they doing? Why are they here? Why should they be in the United States? And all they would have had to do was to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It would have taken a day or so. A day or so, and they were here for almost.
Couldn't they have done it also on an emergency basis?
Well, of course, they could have done it. They could have immediately started listening to them the moment they came in the United States. They could have listened to them the whole time. They were here almost 2 years. And there would have been no legal problem because all you have to do to show the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is that they're suspected terrorists because they're being sent here by Bin Laden himself through his operations center. And the court itself is a very easy court. Out of 20,000 or so requests, they've only turned down two or three or whatever. So the bottom line is they could have eavesdropped on them without any legal problem. They chose not to, and I think it was out of being overly careful, too careful.
We're talking with investigative author James Bamford about his new book, The Shadow Factory, and we will be back in a minute.
Afterwards,
well, that's a good place to break off, and I think if you have any interest in this type of area at all, the foreign intelligence gathering business, this is just an incredible book, and this is a man that's written three books about the National Security Agency. But isn't that incredible that for a year the National Security Agency and its eavesdropping operation was within 3 miles? They shopped at the same stores and exercised in the same gym, and these are the people that pulled off the 9/11 tragedy crime beyond belief. And again, we feel so sorry for the people that were victims of that, and we're still living the aftermath of all of that. Well, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, that's our show for tonight, and we're going to let Vera Lynn take us off tonight. I want to do a little advertising for Vera Lynn. I had a miraculous delivery of a wonderful two-set CD of Vera Lynn, and this is disc one and disc two, and some of the songs on this, the voice quality and the orchestra quality, sound quality are just outstanding. Beautiful songs on there, like Again and Each Moment I Live, on and on and on. You'll really like this if you like Vera Lynn, and I know people have told me that they do from hearing our sign-off. So here we go. We'll see you next week.
Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you. happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know.